Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, it's an obvious truism that we have fetishized food, particularly now with all the sourdough bread on Twitter. And celebrity chefs will tell you the recipe for a dish, but also imply how much more wonderful your life will be as a result of making it. But it's fair to say that this is a very middle-class depiction of how life should be. Penn Vogler investigates his connection between food and social status in her book Scoff, A History of Food and Class in Britain. And she joins us now on News Talk. Afternoon, Penn.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
First thing I want to ask you is about the word supper. Is that a posh thing or is that a lower class thing?
Suppers is, it's a neutral-ish word, but obviously what you have for supper and when you have it and how you have it will say a lot about you. So it might just be you might have a biscuit and some cocoa, you know, after telly with the kids. That can be supper. But to be honest, it's usually used as quite a posh thing, you know, a roast chicken, nice glass, nice bottle of white wine with. And the people who have supper in their kitchens usually have very big kitchens and maybe an aga. And that tells you quite a lot about them. So it's a kind of poshish thing.
Right, okay.
Potentially posh.
In the sense that, like, if you're saying we're going to have a dinner, they don't say we're going to have a dinner party. They want to give the impression that they're... I just noticed, actually, and the only reason I'm asking you this, I watched an episode of The Crown last night, and they're all there patronising Margaret Thatcher. Who knew I could watch a TV show that would make me sympathetic to Margaret Thatcher? But they had supper, and they said, oh, no, it's not supper time yet, and because she turned up too early for
it. Yes, I think that's a common thing in Britain, that and not just supper, but dinner as well. So there's a story that the writer Bridget Jones tells. She grew up in the north, she went to Oxford, she was invited to dinner by her tutor. She turns up in the middle of the day. Of course she does. That's when you have your dinner, you know, if you're from the kind of north or from the working classes.
Right,
and
yeah.
Her tutor had to very politely say, well, actually, you know, dinner time, if you're kind of, you know, Oxford College educated, is really in the evening. And so a lot of us have to learn that the things that we call dinner, tea, supper, lunch, or even the word meal, which are kind of feel normal and neutral to us when we grow up, that other people in other kind of social levels will maybe put us into a little category, judging, you know, using the language we use and using our kind of food expectations and what we eat.
Right.
They'll kind of judge us by it. And that's really what I've been writing about.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Kind of categorise each other.
There was an Irish politician who was speaking about, you know, the ordinary Irish man, you know, less woke times. But when he was asked, what is an ordinary Irish man? He defined the ordinary Irish man as somebody who eats their dinner in the middle of the day. So there's a kind of another, I suppose, reverse example of that. Another example of this. Now, this struck me because we did interview one of the two brothers who set this up. This was a place called Serial Killer. This was a cafe.
Yes.
It was kind of a hipster thing that was serving, you know, Rice Krispies and things at exorbitant prices. What happened to that place?
Well, it got targeted by a group called Class War. So when they were set up in the East End, they didn't charge that much, you know, for a bowl of cereal. It was something like £3.40 or £4. And if they'd have, and they said themselves, you know, if we'd have charged that for a coffee, nobody would have batted an eyelid.
Mm.
But the idea that you can take something that we think by right belongs to children and should be kind of take them out of the kind of class system, you know, in a way that coffee doesn't, and that ends up in a kind of area that's been gentrified. This was catnip for Class War, and they came and they did this whole parade with pig's heads and things. And these two guys had grown up in quite a lot of poverty, apparently, in Belfast. They hadn't been able to afford to go to university. They were just trying to make something of themselves. So it can get very muddled, and we can judge each other and we can punish each other because of our perceptions about food and class, you know, sometimes in quite a kind of damaging way.
Yeah, no, because I think that where they set it up, though, there was a difficulty in the sense that many schools in that area, because it was the East End, would have had breakfast clubs and the like.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's exactly the point that kind of Class War were trying to make, but maybe rather, you know, rather aggressively.
Now, and does it tend to be the case that I mean, I did mention sourdough bread, or bread actually is basically really what it is. But that things like that go in and out of fashion, that fashionable people are eating it and then they realise everybody else is eating it and so then they dump it.
Every bread particularly, because bread is the thing that we have chosen to define us about the way we eat, you know, since the Norman invasion, basically, which is the kind of earliest I go back to. And bread is our kind of flag. And whether you eat white bread or brown bread or sourdough bread, that's the way that you define yourself. And historically, the kind of upper classes have tried to say to the working classes, no, you shouldn't be having white bread. White bread is too refined for you. You need good old solid brown bread to kind of keep you going. And your kind of, you know, your peasants, your digestion can take it. Whereas we refined urban upper classes, we need the nice pure white bread. And of course, and that was a sort of battle that went on for centuries. And then when white flour became refined in, you know, mechanical ways, it was very easy to refine it, then those, that kind of reversed, you know, that image of brown and white bread swapped over for a bit. And then I think it's interesting with sourdough, because I think basically people do like white bread, and sourdough is fantastic because it's given us all the chance to eat white bread again and still feel good about ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah, just without the preservatives and all that kind of. There's a process.
I mean, it is great.
There?
I love. Don't get me wrong. I love sourdough bread.
Yeah. Oh no. So do I. I'm despite myself, sort of thing. but there was something like the Chorley Wood process or something that they invented to mass produce white bread, and that's pretty much the way they still make it. Now, but but I suppose the most acute example of this is the story of gin. Which, you know, at the moment is very trendy. How was gin first introduced to Britain?
Well, gin, people think that gin came in with soldiers who were fighting in the Low Countries, what called the Low Countries, you know, then now Holland, Belgium, brought back. It was called juniper or Hollands after, and it was called Geneva, rather, after the Dutch word for juniper, which it was made from, or it was called Hollands. It was seen as a sort of rather kind of crude, foreign, and very, you know, it's seen in a bit as though it was a bit like crack cocaine, you know, in the inner cities. And in the middle of the 18th century, in a way, it was right, you know, people who were coming to urban places in the 18th century knew kind of drug on the block. They had no sort of social system set up to kind of protect themselves against it. And there was a terrible gin craze, and people would brew the stuff or distill the stuff, you know, in the morning, sell it in the afternoon. And it wasn't regulated. And so they actually brought in this quite clever regulation where they said you can't brew it in small batches. You've got to have a big still. I'm saying brew and I mean distill. You've got to have a big still. And suddenly it meant that those individual people making it couldn't make it any longer. And that was the case for hundreds of years until people started to, the gin makers of today said, oh, that's crazy. Can't we just make a little kind of small batch gin? And HMRC gets, you know, kind of gave in and said, okay, you can make small batch gin now for the first time for 250 years. And so now we have a new gin craze, but it looks very different to the old one.
Yeah.
Because it's much more kind of middle class.
Because I thought William of Orange had something to do with gin first arriving.
Well, I think it's the whole Dutch thing. I don't think it was him specifically, but I think this idea that it came from, you know, the Orange, you know, from William of Orange's kind of country, really. And he would have, yes, he probably popularised it actually in a kind of upper, you know, amongst an upper echelon. But having said that, gin was never popular as a posh drink until it kind of met tonic. You know, and it moved out to the suburbs, settled down, became a bit more kind of acceptable.
Yeah, because I always think of gin and tonic as kind of, I always think of that old show, Reginald Perrin. And it's kind of, you know, connected with kind of the middle class in Surrey sort of thing.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And I think that was partly because it travelled well. And so colonial, you know, people working in what were called the colonies in those days would take the tonic, their malarial, you know, the quinine, the anti-malarial in their tonic, it matched very well with gin. Gin travelled well and it kind of, it became an acceptable sundowner. And then they brought it back home and took it to people like Reginald Perrin. So that was its kind of image for a long time.
Mm. But now that, you know, people are drinking it out of huge glasses and you have a choice of 17 different tonics to go with it, etc., etc., according to your thesis, that will end, though, at some point. It'll go out of fashion and avocados will go with it.
Do you know something? I was thinking about this morning because somebody's asked me to do a talk and a gin tasting, and I was kind of Googling, you know, new gins. And I noticed that, I think, is it Gemma Collins from some TV show? I'm sorry, slightly out of my depth here, has introduced a new gin, and it's pink and it's kind of fruity and it's quite kind of, you know, it's quite shishy, it's quite kitschy. Maybe that's the beginning of the end for gin. You know, I've no idea. I mean, of course, it's not the beginning of the end for gin, but maybe it's the beginning of the end of the way we see gin now as a sort of craft, you know, as something that educated people, they match the right gin and the right tonic, and you get these amazing gin bars with 400, you know, different kinds. And
yeah.
10 quid each or something. Maybe that's beginning. Maybe that will go now.
Well,
and we'll move on to the next thing.
Yeah, we will. But actually, fun enough, the next thing might be whiskey then, because, you know, as people in the know tell me, that you have such a variety of gins at the moment that the distilleries actually want to make whiskey, but they can't. Of course, you have to wait for 5 or 10 years before you can produce a decent whiskey. So in the meantime, you can produce gin.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I think it's very likely, actually, that whiskey will be the next thing because, you know, in a kind of post-Brexit world, we're going to have to find something to celebrate, aren't we? And hopefully if Scotland...
I'm sorry, Pen, we're fine. We're still in the European Union.
You're absolutely fine. Yeah, whiskey with an E would be absolutely fine. Whiskey without the E, perhaps we're going to have to kind of go, everybody, remember this.
I wouldn't rely on whiskey without an E remaining part of the United Kingdom either. Pen, thanks a million for speaking with us today. There was Pen Vogler there. She's the author of Scoff, A History of Food and Class in Britain. We're going to take a break after that. Ocean Rebellion.
Moncrief on News Talk.